is Robert Stark. I'm joined here today with Anatoly Karlin. Anatoly, it's great having you back on.
Thank you.
And I'm also joined here with my co-host, Alex von Goldstein. Alex, great having you on, too.
It's always a pleasure, Robert.
So to start off with is you have this article about Trump and the geography of America, and you list well, there's been sort of this theory called the Seven Nations of America, the different sort of cultural parts of America, and it goes beyond kind of like the stereotypical like red versus blue divide. There's like Dixie, there's sort of like the Black Belt in the South, there's like Ecotopia in the Pacific Northwest, there's sort of a Mexican-influenced part of the United States, there's Yankeedom. But Anatoly, you have this map, and you actually show the areas where Trump's support is the strongest. And what's interesting about it is it kind of crosses over stereotypical, like, blue-red divides, because on one hand, he's very strong in the South, but he's also strong in places like Massachusetts, and I'm sure he's going to do well in New York and New Jersey as well. Anatoly, can you kind of talk about some of these different factors, like what are some of the key cultural and geographic factors that contribute to strong support for Trump?
Okay, so first of all, it's the nine nations of Trump. Why I called my blog post the Seven Nations of Trump, Trump's Seven Nations, is because that seems to be where he's leading in the Republican primary. That doesn't say much about, of course, about results in the general election, but just focusing on the primaries for now. Anyway, the Nine Nations of America was a concept developed by a guy called Joel Garreau in the 1980s. And basically, it looked at America at the divisions, at the cultural and divisions and economic divisions of the United States, and not so much the traditional state line. And what he found was that there, in North America there were nine distinct blocks. You've counted many of them. So there's Ecotopia in the west, in the far west. There's the empty quarter, that's where the where all the mining takes place, that's in the middle of the country, the Rockies, the southern Mex-America, Dixie, which is self-explanatory, the foundry, which stretches from the Great Lakes to New York, which is the state manufacturing powerhouse traditionally. There's New England in the far northeast. And what's interesting about Trump is that how it explains Trump or how it ties into Trump is that what you see from this map is that the two so-called countries of North America, nations of North America that support him most, relatively speaking, is the foundry, which is basically the base of the Union in the Civil War, and Dixie, which is the basically the core of the South. And it's pretty funny how they sort of chummed up. And there seems to be, speaking just of the Republican primaries, a sort of alliance of, basically there's the really strong Dixie and foundry support for Trump, but basically pretty much every other nation supports Trump as well, at least a plurality of them do. Except with the glaring exception of two of them, that's the empty quarter. That's basically places like Utah, Wyoming, Montana. These states where most income derives from resources, The glaring exception to that would be Nevada, which is and Las Vegas.
Do you think there's a factor that Well, Trump obviously owns a lot of property in Nevada. Well, Utah is a very socially conservative state, and Nevada is more permissive towards things like gambling and sex. Could that be a factor, that they're more socially permissive towards support for Trump as opposed to those other states?
Oh, yes, definitely. I mean, Trump going, I mean, contrary to the to what the media might have of it, Cruz is far more socially conservative than Trump, and so are his voters. If you're familiar with Stephen King's books, that's just the representative of evil, of degeneracy, and so on, like in The Stand, for instance, the post-apocalyptic book in which the population gets wiped out by plague. But yeah, it was just a joke, basically.
It's funny because in the
just trying
TV
to like illustrate the spirit, perhaps.
Yeah, in the TV movie version of The Stand, when Randall Flagg takes over Las Vegas, a lot of his followers are carrying Confederate flags, which I find pretty funny.
Oh, okay, I didn't watch the TV version. That's funny. That's so.
Another factor is by ancestry. He does poorly in states like Wisconsin and Minnesota, which are heavily Scandinavian. He does well in places that in the South and the Appalachians that are heavily Scotch-Irish. But he also seems to do well among places that have a lot of Irish and Italian Catholics.
Yep. So basically, that's another commonality. The more within the so-called Hainaut line your ancestors come from, the more averse you seem to be to Trump, because you're too genteel, too milquetoast to support him. The Hainaut line is basically that boundary in Europe which separated so-called core Europe, France, Germany, Scandinavia, England, from the outliers of Europe, and it was distinguished by specific breeding patterns historically.
Is there a strong support for Trump among Russian immigrants in the United States?
Well, it's basically you have to make an allowance for the fact that most Russian immigrants to the United States are in fact Jewish Russian immigrants. So that's one demographic factor we have to keep in mind. But overall, yes, I think at least the plurality of them do support Trump over the other options.
Are there any other immigrant groups that are sympathetic to Trump? Obviously, in general, I would say most immigrants probably have a negative view towards him.
Mm-hmm. Well, ironically, I was reading another poll on and that's for Muslim Americans. Now, obviously, most of them support the Democrats and Hillary Clinton in particular. But what I found quite curious is that amongst the Republican Muslims, a good majority of them supported Trump.
Yeah, and the funny thing about that poll you're talking about is the number of Muslims that were voting in the last election for Republicans or saying that they're going to vote for Republican in the last election. There are many more in this election. There are many more Muslims that say they're going to vote for Republican in this election.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably due to Trump.
Yeah, he's got like a really bright personality, a big man type of domineering personality that I think basically appeals to the less socially egalitarian and more hierarchy liking groups of people.
You also posted a map of support by congressional district, and for the state of California, where both Anatoly and I are from, the strongest support is that, well, first of all, that you have the Inland Empire, which is an eastern suburb of L.A., and that makes a lot of sense because it has a lot of, most of the Republicans there are like working class whites, but interestingly mm-hmm. enough, the other area was the Silicon Valley, which may surprise a lot of people. because that's sort of the center of the liberal establishment, but it's probably because you have a lot of disgruntled tech workers who are angry about the H-1B visas.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, another factor would be that there's a lot, as you say, it's a very liberal area, but on the other hand, if 70 or even 80% of people around here are Democrats, then those 20% of Republicans, this might. I know that we have to bear in mind that all these alt-right or neo-reactionary things are, for the most part, basically confined to the internet. But demographically, they might even make a small dent, actually, in comparative terms and in very, like, specific areas such as, yeah, the Silicon Valley. Probably hosts, like, a third of all the new reactionaries out there.
You have this post titled I-Centrist, and the thing about these kind of labels is if you take... And I've discussed this a lot on my show. If you take certain views, like if you any views that are politically incorrect, you're automatically labeled a right-winger. But you have this very comprehensive political poll of presidential candidates and ideology. And I took the same poll. My results were fairly similar to yours. I basically – you got Donald Trump followed by Rand Paul and Ted Cruz, and you got centrist – I basically got Bernie Sanders, I got Donald Trump, but like a very close second to Bernie Sanders. Then I got Rand Paul, and then at the very bottom I got like the establishment candidates like Hillary Clinton and Jeb Bush. And it really shows you, it kind of shows you sort of this ties back to that kind of concept of radical centrism. Where there's just a lot of overlap between Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders and dissident left and dissident right views.
Well, yeah, exactly. It's like the denizens of a two-dimensional plane, which discover there's a third plane. It's like another vector, and basically it's reasonable, moderate views, as I see it, but without all the cultural Marxist bullshit that all the other mainstream parties subscribe to, pretty much. Of course, I'm a bit biased.
And you break this down, you have these political compass tests. Like there's the Nolan chart, which is popular with libertarians, but I think that's way too simplistic. But you break it up, so capitalism versus socialism, multiculturalism versus assimilation, isolationism versus imperialism, globalization versus protectionism, environmentalism versus anti-environmentalism, decentralization versus decentralization, privacy versus security. Out of those issues, like what do you see as some of like the core principles? I probably agree with most of your. Just going over briefly, I favor a non-interventionist foreign policy. I favor protectionism. I'm pro-environment. I favor restrictions on immigration. I favor more privacy. So. Those are sort of core principles that are not together. They don't fit into the like right wing or left wing views, but sort of like the concept that Alex and I were talking about in our last show, which is radical centrism. So both Alex and Anatoly, you want to comment on that?
You're just basically describing what are common sense positions as Steve Saylor's slogan, invade the world, we just don't want that, but we want to remain sane, and we accept global warming because we understand the principles of thermodynamics, and we accept human biodiversity because we also believe in the principles of natural selection, and it's pretty bizarre how belief or disbelief, if you're right wing, you have to believe that and not the other, and vice versa, if you're on the left, on the conventional spectrum, we just want to be like common sense ultimately.
I think it's like liberals like to accuse conservatives of being of anti-science, but I think when it comes to science, liberals ignore science on HBD, but conservatives ignore science on environmental issues and like global warming. So they both ignore science.
Yeah, I think that people tend to vote with their emotions, or at least they feel like they're part of the liberal tribe or conservative tribe. And both of these places are echo chambers to a degree. So, you know, people stay basically with what's in line of the other members of the group, whereas we think rationally.
Yeah, I mean, people just, they accept a political ideology almost like it's a religion. They don't address each issue on an individual basis.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that, like, basically politics have replaced religion for contemporary Americans for the most part. I mean, even if they are religious, their religion is filtered through their political ideology.
With the sort of concept of radical centrism, Anatoly, would you consider writing a sort of a coherent, like almost like a manifesto to get sort of these points across, or do you think it's more just sort of an abstract idea?
I think that there's definitely a market for an alt left or an alt center. I mean, you've had the guy who calls himself B.W. Rabbit on the internet. You were interviewing him a few weeks back, I recall. There is a sort of little alt-right subset, alt-left/alt-center, who are into this. So, yes, I definitely think that there is a need for a manifesto, a statement of principles, maybe even a short book about this. Unfortunately, I'm really pressed for time with other projects, so I don't really see myself doing it myself, unfortunately.
Maybe you'll have to take up the cause then.
Exactly, I was going to say that. That should be your job, Robert. Didn't you call the term?
I can't claim 100% accuracy on that. Ironically, I've heard actually establishment types like Thomas Friedman, who are big kind of neoliberal globalists, refer to themselves as a radical centrist.
He wrote World is Flat. I don't think he is a radical centrist in our definition of it. He's the total opposite.
I think Trump is kind of going in sort of the right direction towards radical centrism, away from sort of mainstream conservatism, but there's still a sort of demographic. I think he does sort of scare off like a lot of kind of Swipple types who are like well-educated, pro-science, pro-environment, socially moderate to liberal. And these people are not necessarily, these are not people who are on board with like globalism, open borders, political correctness, but they still have a kind of knee-jerk reaction to anything that's perceived as kind of crude or right-wing.
Though I'd say there are a large amount of those people who are closet Trump supporters. They're like they call it the Trump closet. They vote
for Trump,
probably,
but they
never admit it.
I guess not like the people who are like at the rallies, but we'll find out when we see like the election results and in the different areas, especially in the general.
Certainly.
One more interesting thing about Trump is you wrote some comments about Trump and Amtrak, but what's interesting about him is he's very supportive of investing in infrastructure like Amtrak and high-speed rail. What are your thoughts on that and your article you wrote about that?
Well, I personally love trains. They're my favorite transportation mode. So with that respect in particular, yeah, I mean, I fully support, improving the railway system. It's, I travel across the United States on Amtrak.
I take Amtrak in California, but it's really, it's really pathetic. Our infrastructure, the trains are always late, and they always have to like stop to cross another train. It's just a really bad. We have really bad infrastructure. What are your thoughts on the whole proposed like high-speed rail in California?
Yeah, I mean, I hope it happens. I don't particularly have any big hopes that it will happen because there's just too much litigation in the way to be sent. It's not like in Japan or something, or China, where you just take the land, compensate people, and go ahead with it. You have to actually do a lot of litigation. So I don't really have very high hopes for a high-speed train in California, let alone the entire United States.
Any initiatives that do happen, I would fully support them.
Anatoly, you had this article about a UC Berkeley called the USA as a communal apartment, and you break down like statistics about UC Berkeley by demographics. So you basically break up the Asian population by Chinese, Korean, South Asian, Japanese, and you divide the white population by a Jewish and Gentile. So out of all those groups, your article puts actually Chinese are the number one group at a UC Berkeley. That a lot of people talk about that, but what is sort of the significance of that to you?
So it's pretty remarkable that the top university of a state which was like 90% white in the 1950s now has the biggest single minority on campus there, which is higher than the non-gentle whites, is not just the Asians, but one Asian ethnicity, the Chinese. I just thought it was a pretty remarkable statistic when you come to think about it.
Okay, I know Ron Unz has written a lot about the topic of meritocracy in universities, and he's actually made the case if we went towards a truer meritocracy in education and abolished a lot of the nepotism, he says actually Asians would be the biggest benefactors.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's pretty remarkable that this is so, even though affirmative action, if anything, worked against them.
Do you know why the Chinese have risen to number one? I mean, there's some obvious factors, but I'm just curious as to why you think the Chinese, out of even the Asian groups, have risen to number one.
Well, it seems to be a consensus amongst the psychometricians that they have a pretty high IQ,
probably considerably higher than whites. Especially the immigrants, the Asians in the United States in general seem to have been selected for high IQ actually considerably. Back when you were migrating in the late 19th century, you had to pay for the ocean crossing across the Pacific, that would have been actually quite a substantial sum for the Chinese at that time, because most of them were living at the edge of subsistence. So there's that factor. And the third factor is I do think that they have a much much higher work ethic than white and other groups. On the other hand, there was also this article recently, which was covered by James Thompson on his Psychological Commons blog, and it was basically some psychometrician tried to measure the creativity of various population groups. This is one of the big puzzles of
history. Why did the Asians have substantially less innovation than Europeans, even though modern psychometric tests show them to have a 3 to 7 point advantage in IQ. It's not a topic that has been studied very much, but those preliminary results that that James Thompson covered, they indicated that patients actually do seem to have less creativity than other population groups at any given level of IQ. So, I mean, there's obviously some questions have to be
asked about this. So basically, I think that, I mean, obviously, meritocracy in university admissions is a good thing, but here's a thought experiment. If you get more and more Asians than in
the university, and maybe you'll have less innovation in the future than you
otherwise would have, because those Asians would then go on to make money in business instead of going on to become graduate students and work in science and make new discoveries. I don't know, but I guess that's something that should be considered as well.
There is this sort of a concept called the bamboo ceiling, and some Asians who are sort of getting into sort of identity, sort of grievance politics, are saying there is systematic discrimination against them. But it is interesting to point out that they are vastly overrepresented at universities, but at the same time, they're not as represented at the corporate level. But what is interesting is, for some reason, it seems to be that South Asians are having a lot more success in things like becoming corporate CEOs and getting into politics, and you don't – so – I don't think it's racial discrimination, but my take on that is I think the American corporate culture puts a very strong sort of emphasis on things like charisma and extroversion.
Of course, yeah. I mean, this is just an extension of the fact that although HBZ might be mostly about IQ, it's not far from everything about it is about IQ. And so, I mean, the stereotype of Indians, with which I agree with, is that they're basically chatterboxes, they're socially fluent. So it's not surprising to me that they would have an outsized share of the CEO population, because that's what it calls for. If you look at the Forbes 400, for instance, you'll notice that the Jews, for instance, they are massively overrepresented amongst billionaires, even when you take the one standard deviation advantage in IQ into account. But then again, you look at other groups from the Levant, like the Greeks, the Christian Levantines, for instance. And you'll actually notice this curious fact that they're actually hugely overrepresented as well. So Carlos Slim, the Mexican billionaire, third richest person in the world, he's a Levantine originally. So it does seem to be that particular group, for instance, has that extra, I don't know, money-making or social fluency or whatever you call it, factor, in addition to IQ that makes them flourish like more than they otherwise would based on just IQ scores. So you do have to take all of these things into account. So I would agree with you that the bamboo ceiling probably isn't a thing, just like the glass ceiling for women isn't a thing.
Alex, what are your thoughts on that?
My thoughts on the bamboo ceiling? Well, it is interesting what Anatoly's saying about Indian CEOs, because you certainly see a pretty high percentage of them. I mean, what companies have Indian CEOs? I know Pepsi did. I'm not sure if they still do. Do you know Anatoly?
I don't know. I don't know the details. I don't follow. I just follow general statistics, like
sure.
Forbes.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, So do you think that it's really a combination of a high IQ and a high like verbal ability that can allow certain groups to succeed? Or how much do you think ethnic networking plays into this? Especially with Jews, I would imagine that ethnic networking would be a huge deal. It was a question for you. It's like verbal ability and high IQ, but what about like ethnic networking?
So this is basically a I don't know. I'm not part of those networks, and I just don't have the sufficient data to know. I mean, it's possible that these networks there's also
just basically statistical factors. Like take the Jews again. Say you have a Jew and a white who are completely equal in IQ, in verbal IQ, in charisma, in social skills, and so on. Okay. The family members and the friends of the Jew are in turn more likely to be more intelligent and probably and presumably richer because there's a correlation between the two. So they the Jew would also have a higher chance of accessing say a low interest loan from his network. So even in this condition of absolute equality, of ostensibly of equality, the Jew would still have an advantage. But is it because of those correlations, or is it because of the network of something to do with that with ethnic networks? Well, maybe it's just a matter of semantics at this point.
Yeah, it definitely makes sense.
Anatoly, you have this article called Millionaires Flee Sinking Europe, and we were on the topic of the Chinese, and obviously there's been a lot of Chinese millionaires buying up real estate in California, but this is really remarkable. Actually, I'm reading France has surpassed China as the country that has the largest millionaire exodus. But the key issue is this because of taxation or because of the current situation, the migrant crisis and terrorist attacks, or you think a combination of both?
Well, if you read the report that estimates those figures, the biggest complaints are about the vibrant diversity that is increasing in throughout Europe. And
especially France. And, of course... the
socialist government doesn't really
make things good
for them either. So you might have heard that that François Hollande and his government tried to raise the top income tax bracket to 80%. They failed with it, but still, in the current globalized world, nationalism is no longer a thing, and it's a race to the bottom. In terms of taxation, and everybody is trying to get an offshore haven, and so it's
entirely natural that
in these circumstances, people will increasingly gravitate, especially those millionaires, because most millionaires
have the means to just move from one country to another. It's hard for ordinary folks because they have to arrange passports and buy properties and so on. But in many countries you can get a permanent residence in many countries just by investing, say, $500,000 in some industry there or something. Well, under globalized conditions, millionaires are fleeing from the sinking Mediterranean, which is where the economic crisis is happening, from Greece, from Italy, and also for reasons of diversity. So basically, like, London is very paradoxical, but also illustrates in this regard, in that all the European millionaires are like settling down in London, and a lot of the Arab millionaires, whereas the native British London millionaires are going away to places like Australia or California.
There is this argument put out by mainstream conservatives that if you basically soak the rich, then the rich will just leave and move somewhere else and take their money with them. and that harms the economy. But then on the other hand, there's this sort of a nationalist, populist argument that if the rich are disloyal to their country and if they're in favor of harmful policies, if they're globalists, their attitude is more like, good riddance, we don't need these people. Which of those views do you find more accurate, or do you think there's a sort of nuanced view in between?
Well, I think they're both entirely accurate, actually. So that's basically one of the big challenges that all states face, is how to keep the elites loyal to them. So the United States keeps the elites loyal because they have rule of law, they're a global power, they understand globalization, and it's really just a very nice place for very rich people to live. So it's hard to avoid taxes in the United States because the IRS is pretty hardcore, but on the other hand, those taxes aren't
very high like they are in Europe. And there's lots of things to do in the United States. It's got skiing resorts, it's got beaches, it's got everything that people need. Other countries are not so lucky. Maybe they have high crime rates, so millionaires flee from them. Maybe they have very high taxation rates. Maybe they have they don't have rule of law. And basically, once barriers break down, once globalization increases, once nationalism declines, because nationalism is another thing that might keep people in their own country, but now that it's getting discredited, you basically have a sort of great flushing of all these millionaires to just a few favorable gated communities like countries.
Your point is that both of those arguments are relevant. So how do you reconcile that that those arguments in favor of sensible policies? Because on one hand, you don't want to drive out all the millionaires and have all that massive amount of wealth leave the country. But at the same time, you don't want to have large numbers of wealthy individuals who are corrupting the political process and causing harm. So how do you create sensible economic policies that reconcile those two different views?
Okay, you should try as hard as possible to have impartial courts and
rule of law and low crime rates. I mean, that everybody agrees that those are good
things and they don't really conflict with anything else. So that's the obvious thing to do. Another thing, in a globalized world, unless you want to start setting
up high-end curtains, then top tax brackets of much more than 50% are
unrealistic, and you probably shouldn't bother with them. Third, you should be pretty hardcore about fighting offshoreists, preferably. So that they don't take the, so there's less incentives to take the money out of the country, but you can attract money instead by offering guarantees that the money won't vanish
by suppressing inflation, so that people, the rich, know that their money is basically safe in the country, and by promoting nationalist propaganda,
so that people are persuaded to be patriotic as well. But I don't see how you can do much more, and how to prevent them influencing the political system. That's also a big challenge. Of course, I don't think it's possible to. I mean, in virtually every country, there's a lot of interflow between money and power and money.
How do you think you could make effective nationalist propaganda in the 21st century when it's something that's been so maligned? How do you think that someone could make effective nationalist propaganda now?
Keep out the Western media and human rights NGOs.
And dollars.
So with the whole situation in Europe and things, you have all this chaos with the migrant crisis, and if things continue, things are going to get worse. But Anatoly, do you think there could be a massive exodus of Europeans out of Europe into, like, say, the United States, Canada, and Australia?
Well, it's really a question of which exponential curve is going to win out, right? The date at which native Europeans get red-pilled and start voting for people like the National Front and Alternative for Deutschland and these sorts of parties, and the date at which the rising tide of color overwhelms them, right? So it's basically this sort of battle of the exponentials that takes place here. And I don't know which of them will win. I don't think it's too late. I think there's still breathing room of 10 to 20 years, but after that, you're basically going to start getting revenue scenarios in which the current parties start having even less ideological differences than they do now, and simply become firms for ethnicity. So, like, the socialist parties will probably become essentially Muslim parties. The old right parties, the currently rightist parties, will become firms for native Christian ethnicities. So that's the way I see it going.
And, of course, I don't think many people will be all that thrilled about it. And, yes, if it comes down to such a scenario, then, yes, I think that you will start getting pretty big outflows of people just like you did from Lebanon once they really became multicultural by the 1980s.
And what's ironic about that scenario is that if Europe is destroyed, then it would in some ways kind of reverse America's demographic changes.
Yeah, that would be pretty funny if that happened. Pretty ironic as well. Yeah, I mean, in the long term, even I do think that the United States has better prospects than Europe, because there's more freedom of speech in the U.S. You can actually point things out without people, without the police going up to you and telling you to tone it down on Twitter and stuff like that. And ultimately, Hispanic immigrants are much better than Muslim immigrants.
Do you think, like, a Bernie Sanders presidency would put the U.S. more in the European direction socially, to a point where maybe things like free speech would be under question?
Hard to say. I mean, I don't really see any major difference between Bernie and Hillary on this point. If anything, I think it's. Hillary who is more beholden to all these SJW and ethnic minority grievance groups. The demographics don't look good, because if you look at the demographics of support for freedom of speech in the United States, it's generally the younger demographics who want to have prosecute hate speech, or what people say is hate speech.
It's about 40% of millennials who oppose free speech. And a sort of interesting idea that goes alongside this is that 40% of millennials are also immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
So is that does causation equal correlation there?
I think I recall reading that it's even amongst whites it's the same. Actually it seems to be more like the younger whites, they're basically bifurcating into two camps amongst the millennials. There's the SJWs at one extreme,
And there's the alt-right idea, it seems. But it seems that the SJWs are pulling in more people on average than the to in that direction than the alt-right is pulling into.
Anatoly, you have this post on immigrant crime rates in Germany, and this ties in with what we were talking about the migrant crisis. So I'll just look over this briefly. So for murder rates, interestingly enough, Lebanon has the highest murder rate in Germany, and that group in particular in the United States has done been a very successful immigrant group. And that's one interesting observation. And as far as rates for sexual assault, North Africans are by far have the highest rates of sexual assaults. Syria actually is fairly low on that list. I mean, Syria is even below European countries like Serbia. And Syria is a lot of the focus with the migrant crisis is on Syria. So can you comment on both of those statistics?
Okay. So basically, the thing about that survey is just a quick note that was carried out. The statistics it was based upon was before the massive 2015 immigration crisis. First of all, secondly, yes, this is a very curious and intriguing point that Algeria, Morocco, Tunisia. They're actually pretty civilized country. Well, apart from all the like terrorism that Algeria had a civil war in the 90s, but I mean, if you just look at the statistics, the murder rates are pretty low. Actually, they're like comparable to Europe almost. It's only when they come to Europe that their criminality explodes. So I think this is one case where culture and environment might actually play a bigger role than purely HPD factors. It's basically the breakdown of the traditional village structures that kept them in check back in their own countries. They're basically removed once they come to Europe. They're anonymized, and so criminality goes up by an order of magnitude. So yeah, that's the case with them. Another thing about you also have to treat the statistics from Eastern Europe with caution, because in particular countries like Hungary, Serbia, a lot of Gypsies, so they might be skewing the statistics somewhat. That's just worth bearing in mind. And they're pretty fascinating, and it's all based on. It's not something that was invented. It was based on actual police records from Germany those days. So they do show that, generally speaking, that once you open up the borders, you'll get this underclass of people who will be quite who have criminality rates comparable to that of the black ethnicity in the United States.
And why is Lebanon so high on murder rates? Because you mentioned earlier people from Syria and Lebanon and the United States have done very well as a group.
So two factors. It's considerably easier for somebody from Lebanon to immigrate to Europe than to the United States. The Atlantic Ocean is a great eugenic policy in some sense. That's first. And secondly, I mean, as I pointed out earlier, Lebanon is multicultural. We don't know the composition of the immigrants from Lebanon. We know that in the United States they're mostly Christian Levantine, and in Lebanon itself, Christian Levantine tend to be the cosmopolitan, the most educated, the richest part of the population. Maybe it's the case that most of the immigrants to Germany are Sunni Levantine. So, but without knowing those particular details, we can only speculate. I'm
it would be great if we had more detailed statistics, but generally speaking, European countries shy away from gathering statistics of this sort.
Now, you said the United States immigration policy has an element of eugenics in it?
That the Atlantic Ocean is a, that the width of the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans is a eugenic policy.
You've been writing some articles back on the topic of Trump about Trump's relationship with Russia and how he sort of challenged the establishment and neoconservative orthodoxy on that. And you talk about Trump's recent comments on that NATO has become kind of useless. And you also comment on the fact that Trump is actually right on Putin and journalists. And I haven't really researched the whole journalist thing extensively, but I remember a while back there was a Russian journalist who died of a poison attack in London, and the mainstream media blamed it on Putin. So what are your overall thoughts on Trump and his views towards Russia?
Just to clarify the point about journalists in Russia is that, yes, a lot of journalists have been murdered in Russia. And, of course, the Western, and a lot of them have been opposition journalists, and a lot of them have been just ordinary journalists. And, of course, the Western media has tended to blame Putin, or at least the environment he created, for this. If, however, you actually look at the statistics in depth, you will notice first that more journalists actually were murdered under Yeltsin, the pro-Western democratic Yeltsin, who ruled from 1992 to 2000, than were killed under Putin, who ruled from 2000 to 2002, well, like for the entire post-2000 era. So twice as long, but fewer journalist murders under the Dark Lord Putin than under the pro-Western Yeltsin. The Western media doesn't tend to say anything about that. Secondly, the number of murders of Russian journalists since 2010 has tailed off, and there haven't been any at all for the past 3 years, which suggests that those murders were primarily the result of the general crime situation in Russia, which has generally subsided in the past 15 years.
You said that they blame the deaths on the culture or the climate that Putin creates. How much of an impact has he had on the culture?
Well, I mean, basically the Western media says that he creates a culture of impunity, of criminality, and so on, because he's KGB and whatever. Those claims don't really they're sort of loose that way. What I am basically saying is that more journalists were murdered under the pro-Western Yeltsin, first of all, and secondly, in general, the number of journalist murders have tracked pretty closely the overall murder rate in Russia, which peaked in the 1990s and early 2000s. And has declined to basically Soviet levels, which were much lower. And in tandem, also journalist deaths have also there haven't been any in the past 2 years, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists, to collect these statistics. So it would suggest that the journalist deaths were the product of the general crime situation in Russia. But of course, the Western media is obsessed with blaming it all on Putin. And what Trump said, he basically pointed this out. He dared to go against the consensus of blaming it all on Putin, and instead pointed out that the legitimate fact that there is no proof that he was in fact responsible for any of those murders, for which he was predictably demonized by the Western media, like the entirety of the Western media, especially the neocons, whose whole narrative of the evil Dark Lord Putin offing off every critical journalist, because it undermines that narrative. It goes against it.
So that's like one of the reasons why the Western Egypt like establishment doesn't like Trump very much.
If Trump were elected, how do you see a U.S. foreign policy towards Russia as being, as opposed to how it is now?
I'd not see Trump as a Russophile or any of the sort. He appears to be, that's what you say to it, an
American patriot. So I don't expect to see any like major concessions or anything of the sort to Russia. What I do expect, though, to see is that the United States right now is obsessed with Russia, with countering everything Russia does. Like even in
Syria, there were like lots of crazy neocons calling to establish a no-fly zone, even after Russia sent fighters there, which have led to a full-scale war. So I mean. But this is just a crazy extreme that's been unduly influencing U.S. foreign policy for the past 20 years, the Cold War years, the neocons. If Trump is the man that we hope he is, then he'll expunge the influence of those neocons and will actually start doing what's in America's interest instead of what is in neocons' interest. And that by itself, an American patriot instead of a neocon patriot in the White House would improve the U.S. relations by a great deal.
We're getting towards the end of the show. Before I wrap things up, Alex, do you have anything else you want to ask Anatoly?
Well, I mean, I think some people see a Trump presidency really reversing the U.S.-Russia relations, and I know we talked about this a bit, but what do you think the relationship between Trump and Putin would be, and what effect would that have on, let's say, like the European Union or Western Europe, a Trump-Putin alliance?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think that it will be an alliance, strictly speaking, because there's a whole bunch of institutional factors that will just prevent from happening. Well, I mean, at the most basic level, NATO. I mean, Trump might say that dealers should start paying more for NATO and so on, but once you come to the practicalities of making real change, it's inevitably going to like diminish in its effect once you become a president. I do think that he will set. It does have the potential to set things off on a better vector that will diminish the likelihood of crashes in the future. So, like for the past 20 years, for instance, NATO has been expanding inexorably towards Russia's borders and has almost reached Georgia and Ukraine by the
time of the late Bush administration, and that's despite the well-known fact that there were verbal promises by U.S. and German officials to the Soviet Union in the late 1980s that if Gorbachev allowed the reunification of Germany, then NATO would not exploit it to advance eastward, but that was totally broken by them. Simply because of the institutional influence of those Cold Warriors and neocons in the halls of power in Washington, and of Russophobes, the plain Russophobes like Zbigniew Brzezinski. I see the potential more in the long term, if Trump becomes president, if he is the person he claims to be, then the influence of these
of these lobbies will be massively reduced or maybe extinguished altogether. And so at least, while I don't necessarily see NATO rolling back and all this other expansionism rolling back, though it will at least lose its impetus. And that in turn will reduce the potential for conflict further down the line, because getting that $10 rolling again would require another radical change in political power.
Anatoly Karlin, I would like to thank you for being on. It's been a great show.
Okay, thank you.
And I'd also like to thank Alex von Goldstein for being on.
Thanks, guys. Mm-hmm. It's been great.
Thanks again. That's all we have for today's show. So take care, and we'll be back with you next time.
Okay. Have a nice day. Bye-bye.